Joseph Lindsley is a traveler and writer and American, reporting for Chicago's WGN radio from Ukraine each and every weekday of Russia's full-scale war. He is, I believe, the only journalist on the ground who is reporting with this regularity right from the start. He was once protege to Fox News founder Roger Ailes, but Lindsley escaped that frenzied world where power matters more than truth. He came to Lviv in Ukraine for a Ukrainian Catholic University journalism conference on information overload, AI, and responsibility, and stayed. Joseph, welcome to the channel.
Jonathan, great to speak with you. I feel very somber in many ways today, but also hopeful. I'm talking to you from the Ukrainian city of Kharkiv, which before the full-scale invasion was the second biggest city in this country. I love this place, and I come here very often. And today I arrived on the morning train from Kyiv, and the train left at about 6 a.m., so I didn't have time to check the news about what had happened. I was running late for the train. But when the train arrived here in Kharkiv, I had cell service, and I began to read the news and see that this city, that the Russians had sent several flocks of their Iranian suicide drones to this city in one of their double tap attacks, which means, you know, they attack and then they wait till rescue workers show up and then they attack in that moment. And so several firefighters lost their lives. And as I'm reading that news, I'm getting settled in my place here in Kharkiv, and there was no power. Currently, I have no power. I travel with a ridiculous supply of, like in Corona times, people carried like boxes of masks. Now I carry helmet, bulletproof vest, and tons of power banks to keep going here. But as I was getting settled in my flat here in Kharkiv, the air raid alarm went off, and one of the channels I follow in the Russian language for Kharkiv citizens, it said, hey, everyone be cautious. Lately, the Russians have been sending a new type of missile. It's really hard to detect. At any point, something could happen, and we might not have any warning at all. And as I'm reading this message, you hear that awful, hideous sound, the thud of a rocket hitting the city. It seems that it hit what was a longtime nuclear research facility, going back to the Soviet days, is what they seem to have hit today. And so here we are in this city that, you know, for the past several weeks, when I was here even several weeks ago, there's been frequent power outages, many attacks. Even yesterday, we heard that the drones, it seems, I was talking with people here all day today. Usually you can always hear these drones, and that's why Ukrainians call them mopeds, or it sounds like a lawnmower, you could say. You hear it, and it's very sinister, but at least you can hear it coming. You have time to kind of maneuver, maybe, unlike with a missile. But what I heard from people last night, they would hear the drones, and then they'd hear silence. And then they'd hear the drone again, which means that they have some sort of new ability to glide for a while to help them hide from Ukrainian air defense. Also suppositions that they have some kind of new coating that prevents radar from picking them up. So we are seeing, Russia has always been trying to do everything they can to destroy Ukraine. And if you give them time, they find new ways to do it. So that's felt very keenly here in the city. But despite that, this afternoon, it's a beautiful sunny day. Cafes are still open on generators. There's places that are boarded up because of previous missile attacks. Their windows are boarded, and the words you see on those boarded up windows are often "My pratsvoimo." We are working. We're still working. You know, come on in. And the parks are filled. There are people here. So that's why I travel here, Jonathan. Because, you know, when the world is sort of forgetting about these places, this is the capital of courage. It shows the possibility of victory. And Anthony Blinken the other day in Kyiv, I'm sorry, in Paris, he said, "Kyiv will not fall. It's impossible." Well, I want people to ask, why do you only talk about Kyiv? Why do you not talk about Kharkiv? Why does this not matter to you? And that's the reason why I'm here, to share the stories of these people in this city.
Of course, the idea must be implicit there, and this is where Russian propaganda gets through, that Kharkiv is a predominantly Russian-speaking city and somehow, is worthless or shouldn't be fought for, or if it falls to Russia, then maybe that's not the worst thing. There seems to be almost an implied judgment there, which is very much what Russian propaganda wants us to think. But you're painting a different picture of people, whether they speak Russian, whether they speak Ukrainian, it's immaterial. They're Ukrainian, they want to be part of Ukraine, and they are staying. They're staying to defend their city, their businesses, and their lives.
Yeah, and this is, it's, you know, narrative and is the best science of the particular to actually, you know, get beyond the data and look at the people in the place. But if we see, you know, we have these false narratives. For example, over the weekend, Elon Musk tweeted his, you know, latest opinion on Ukraine, formed without ever coming here to visit. And he said, the west of Ukraine will not fall. He said the resistance there is too strong. People will always resist. There's no way that Lviv and such places will fall into Russian hands. But he says, unfortunately, in the east, the east is going to fall all the way up to the left bank of the Dnieper River, and that's the river that divides Kyiv in two. And this is patently ridiculous. In fact, you know, if you were here in Kharkiv City for just a couple hours, he doesn't even have to come here. He could send some emissary from his team for just a few hours. Before you ride off an entire people, you can take a train, you can safely, and have a nice coffee in the train, a nice meal. It's very pleasant. Take a train, come here, and see the reality before you write these people off. But actually, this is sort of the capital of resistance, because in Lviv, I mean, you know, it's you know, the war still touches people in every possible way, and there's a lot of wounded people there, and you can't plan for your future. In Lviv, its life is, I mean, we have some Americans visiting right now to volunteer, and they said, I'd rather be in Lviv than in Los Angeles or New York or many other places. It is such a pleasant place. But there's not, you know, I mean, there are sometimes attacks there, but it's not intense like it is here. And so the people here in Kharkiv, they are like the vanguard of the resistance. They are like the supreme resistors, because they have to do it every day and because they go through these missile and drone strikes. So for Elon to you know, it shows a complete misunderstanding of it. But it's not just Elon Musk that says, you know, he says it more explicitly. But this is the de facto policy of the White House. They don't care about the city. And I think, as we said before, I mean, I was talking, there was a reporter from Washington who said she was getting her fancy coffee here in Kharkiv, and said it's just too bad these people don't realize the city's going to fall into Russian hands. But you don't see any sign of that. And a couple of weeks ago, a Russian politician said we're going to bomb the hell out of Kharkiv until the people get in their cars and leave. And this is a change, because now we're starting to see that, you know, I mean, these are Russian speaking people, which, I mean, more and more they're doing their best to speak Ukrainian because they're so sick of anything, like any affection they might have had for any kind of Russian language or culture. After you get bombed enough, you say enough of that. And so that's really changed. But you know, everyone here grew up speaking Russian, and until 2022, they were speaking that. And Russia's first, you know, rhetorical, you know, sort of public rhetoric was, we're going to liberate these people. And now they're explicitly saying we're going to bomb until they leave, because we know that they won't, you know, they know that they can't invade the city, because everyone will, you know, they have Molotov cocktails and they're armed to the teeth. And they've tried in 2014 to do it. They tried in 2022. So now it really seems their strategy is to delete the city. And unfortunately, in the West, the leaders don't even, they write off the city, and they do it even by just simply not talking about it. That's why I come here to report from here, because when the full-scale invasion started, I had already been to Kharkiv in January of 2022, and I heard so many stories about how people resisted in 2014 with much less resources. And I said, Kharkiv for me was the indicator that Ukraine was not going to lose. And so this is why I'm here, to try to push back against, you know, the narratives that smother the reality and the truth.
And there is so much truth out there about what Russia does to populations that it controls, to cities that it takes over. People just have to see that extraordinary, powerful piece of work, 20 days in Mariupol. And as I've done, you know, speak to people who actually made it out of that city, who used to call that city home. And you realize that it's quite the opposite from liberation. It is an extermination, is what would happen under Russian control. And of course, the propagandists, you say, are absolutely explicit about that now. They say destroy all utilities. And to an extent, if you listen to their genocidal rhetoric, they would not trust any Ukrainians to remain in the city, even ones that would choose to remain, as a small minority may choose, you know, be sort of indifferent as to who controls them. But most would flee. But we know how Russia behaves now. So this is a blatant, willful ignoring of the facts? Because if you were to embrace the facts as a decision maker in Washington or Berlin, for instance, you would have to take action. You'd have to mobilize your people, mobilize your economy. Therefore, it's easier to bury that truth and pretend it's not there.
Well, first I'll say, when we talk about who controls it, and this is where I think it gets lost in a lot of the conversations about Ukraine in the West, like, Russia is a society where the government controls. It's about control. Ukraine, the people control, and so it's not about Ukraine, some kind of government, or, you know, the administration of President Zelensky controlling. It's not that. It's the people who control. They're very independent. I mean, you know, I was talking yesterday with some Ukrainian soldiers, and just talking about life here, and, you know, how the police, you know, are very respectful of the people. They almost bow before the people because they know that the authority is the people. This is an inversion of so much of what we see around the West, and certainly what we see in Russia. So control is, Russia is about control. Ukraine is about freedom, and that's the essence that we see here every day. But I think this, you know, you really feel, especially being in a place like this, and when these attacks happen, as I was here a few weeks ago during some terrible attacks, and you listen to the rhetoric from the Kremlin, Russia's goal is this maniacal, it's sick and it's maniacal, is to destroy these people that have built these lovely cities, and wipe them off the face of the earth. And I think a lot of it is jealousy. Hatred for people that can make something good that is out of their orbit, and it's sick. I mean, it's what we saw, you know, with the Nazis and Hitler. And I think, but a key thing, like, we look at that 20 days in Mariupol, and actually it was a Kharkiv guy that was the director of that, and it's a very powerful and very important film that's documented. But I think right now, as we're looking, if you want to reach the Americans, more stories of tragedy does not really help. The people who already were going to care about that care. But for many people, it's the same old. And I think the more tragic stories you see, the more it seems like, oh, geez, this is impossible. Why don't, you know? And this is what we hear, the rhetoric we hear, the sort of Kissinger style rhetoric, even though, you know, may rest in peace, but, you know, of Jake Sullivan and others. You know, cool your jets and your freedom a little bit. Why can't you just, you know, put up with some, you know, being under Putin, you know, and all this is really the mentality. And I think that's another reason why I like to be here in Kharkiv, because Kharkiv is not Mariupol right now. It's not Bakhmut. The Russians want to do this and they're trying piece by piece, but it's a huge city. You know, I mean, it was Ukraine's second biggest city, one of the, you know, bigger cities in Europe, with an advanced subway system. Safer and cleaner than New York's, by the way, and a massive infrastructure, a city of universities, and even now in this time, you see a city that's a great place to be, and I think I want Americans to see that. I made this video with the members of our team called Midnight in Kharkiv. Have you ever seen, you know, Woody Allen's Midnight in Paris? That the opening sequence with the music of Sidney Bechet. And you just see the scenes of Paris for 4 minutes in the rain and in the sunshine. And so we made a video like this about Kharkiv. But instead of rain and sunshine, it's beautiful moments of peace and Russian attack. And it's you. But you see, even now, the rebuilding is happening even in this time. And I think it's probably, I've told you before, but, you know, I'm here, you know, I was here in January, say there was a cafe that was destroyed. I come back in March, that cafe is rebuilt, even though it could be destroyed tomorrow. And so this, and I, this gets totally lost in all of the rhetoric and fancy talk from Washington. I mean, the past few days we've had Secretary Pritzker, United States Secretary of Commerce, was in Ukraine and talking about rebuilding. They always talk about rebuilding. And they always say, well, what are we going to do, you know, after victory? But just missing the very important thing, how do we get there? Why not just send the weapons? And the rebuilding talk bothers me because the rebuilding is happening. If you're in Lviv, your first, what kind of rebuilding needs to happen there? They rebuild. They've already rebuilt things that were destroyed last summer. In Kyiv, there's, you know, there's always building happening. Bucha, Irpin are really lovely places again. They've been restored 2 years after the massacres that happened there. There will have to be rebuilding in occupied places, but, you know, first we got to free those places. And in Kharkiv, even businesses are reopening. And so when they talk about rebuilding, you know, it bothers me for two reasons. One, because it plays into the American sort of the Mike Johnson American conservatives who oppose Ukraine. They're like, oh, look, we see BlackRock and all these globalist people moving into Ukraine to take advantage. And you know what? There's actually a lot of truth to that. You know, they're waiting for the right moment because this country has amazing, vast resources. And minerals and farmland and everything, and they are indeed trying to take advantage. And yet they'll happily talk about that, but the people that talk about investing in Ukraine and rebuilding, most of them will say not a peep about sending long range weapons, air defense. This city right now, I mean, any moment I could have a missile in my face, or glass in my face, because there's no air defense here to protect the city. There's no desire to protect this. And I think, Jonathan, about like the drone attack that happened here last night, where in the double tap attack, several firefighters were killed. There was a young firefighter who went there. He happened to get there at the same time as his father, who's a also a first responder, his 52-year-old father. And his father was killed when the next wave came. And there's a video of this young guy, young firefighter, just crying, sobbing. And police and other officials are hugging him and just trying to calm him down. It's just an absolute disgusting hell. And this is from the drones that are Iranian designed. Now, seemingly, a lot of them are made in Russia. And a few days ago, Ukraine had an incredible success by sending Ukrainian-made drones 1,200 kilometers deep into Russian territory to hit, among other things, a drone production facility. And what does Washington say the next day in Paris? Anthony Blinken in Paris said, you know, that Washington does not endorse this. And so much so, it was an astounding scene because the French foreign minister was at a press conference right next to Blinken. And he disagreed publicly with the U.S. Secretary of State. And he said, our policy is not really to make a comment, but Ukraine has the ability to defend itself against an aggressor. It's better to make no comment than to say, we don't endorse Ukraine, attacking things on Russian soil. But how can you say that? If you like, when what are we supposed to do? What exactly is supposed to be done? Do we just sit here and die in Kharkiv? Do we leave Kharkiv? What does Washington want?
It's an extraordinary turn, because if you translate that into historical examples, it, you know, rather than seeming sensible, if you put a layer of sort of, you know, realist international relations guff over the top of it, if you actually translate that into historic examples, it would be like saying to Britain, well, you can defend your territory, but don't hit Nazi Germany. Don't touch Berlin. Not allowed to do that. Or after 9/11, you know, by all means, protect your territory, but don't go after anybody else.
I'm glad you brought that up, because that is the perfect thing. And, you know, the fact is, so much of our defense establishment on the left and the right, you know, totally endorsed that, including Biden when he was a senator. We lost a lot of people and prominent American landmarks on 9/11. And what do we do for the next 20 years? We had places very far away, not in our territory. And Ukraine can't even have precise, by the way, these are effective attacks. And if you can't ever even congratulate Ukraine on this, you know, how can you possibly win the narratives? And this is why, I mean, the White House is whatever, you know, I can call it cowardice, but I, you know, the White House's failure to allow Ukraine, you know, even to have no comment on this, but to fail to allow Ukraine to push for victory in a real way to protect places like Kharkiv gives cover to the Republicans who want to, you know, cower and hide from this. You know, they're all sort of complicit in this. But if you look at the BBC headline on Monday, after Ukraine, you know, had this very successful drone attack 1,200 kilometers into the Russian Federation. I don't know if you saw this, Jonathan, but the BBC's headline was this: deepest Ukraine drone attack into Russian territory injures 12. And, you know, if you're someone sitting in your kitchen in California, or you're driving to work somewhere in Austin, Texas, and you hear this, you're like, oh, this just needs to stop. Why are Ukrainians killing and injuring? And it totally misses the point. Like that facility that they hit has killed thousands. Thousands. And even some of the stories say in Western media that the students were injured. That's what the Russians were saying, the students were injured. Well, it seems as you look a bit deeper that it was engineering students building drones that are killing Ukrainians. So, yeah, students of you know, okay, but they're making things that kill people in their homes every night in Ukraine. So, and this is how, even when Ukraine does something extraordinary, it's like they don't get the positive story about it. And so, and then it looks like Ukraine is losing and everyone just says, let's give up on it. When really we have so many great stories to report. I mean, as difficult as it is here in Kharkiv, it's a reminder, you know, Kharkiv is hit because it's so close to Russia. Kyiv is very well protected. And the Russians have realized that they can't so easily and successfully attack deeper within Ukraine. So now they're just trying to pound places like this. But for all the horrible things that have been happening really since 2024 began, Ukrainians are having some great successes, especially in the Black Sea. I mean, it's dangerous for a Russian ship to be in the Black Sea for more than a few hours, if that.
And this is an extraordinary story, isn't it? I mean, that Black Sea is a remarkable story because at the time, there were also rumors that the US wasn't particularly happy about the Black Sea fleet being targeted, and indeed air bases and other facilities on Crimea. There's a certain amount of disquiet. So publicly, they were saying, yes, you know, you can hit places within your sovereign territory. But we got the sense they weren't particularly thrilled by it. And, you go into this thought process of escalation management, of fears of escalation and so on. What we saw in reality is Russia can do nothing about it. And as soon as Ukraine started to do that and repel Russia from the Black Sea, its trade exports went up and up and up and returned to their previous level, which is a critical strategy for earning money to keep Ukraine in the fight and resilient. So what's disturbing about this, and it's been many months ago that I first sort of started to float the idea that, you know, the incrementalism, the incremental supply of munitions is not just accidental or due to bureaucratic inertia and whatever, that there's a genuine strategy there to try and balance the battlefield, to make sure Russia doesn't lose too badly, doesn't gain too much. An extremely misguided, one could even say immoral and cynical strategy. Now, it's no longer in the subtext. It's blatantly and openly admitted by the US, and one presumes that Berlin is quite possibly aligned with this strategy. France, however, as you mentioned in your comments just now, seems to be breaking away from that. To use the colloquial phrase, Macron seems to have grown a pair, and there's been a fundamental change in attitude.
Yeah, well, you know, first, I think, you know, we have to, I mean, it's impossible to know what is, you know, on people's hearts, but we look at their actions and you know, in a way, I mean, it's, you know, there was a conspiracy theory among diehard supporters of President Biden for a while that he secretly was trying to do more. And maybe he himself wants to, but his administration is not. But that's a conspiracy theory. And actually, we see in practice, you know, it's 2 years. I mean, do we need 20 years to prove it? I know we like 20-year wars, but it's very clear, especially with Blinken's comments about drones, about hitting the drone facility. And then if you look at the Black Sea story, is something that is not talked about much. And, it, you know, if if we when Ukraine had that deal, that United Nations Turkey brokered deal, that, you know, for the, basically the first year of the full scale invasion, that, you know, so benevolently allowed the grain to be exported to the Black Sea, they're now exporting more grain than they were when they had that deal, significantly more, in a shorter space of time. It's been less than a year since it expired. And because when that deal expired, then they were able to actually fight. But when the deal was there, it totally benefited Russia. Ukrainians weren't allowed to hit anything in the Black Sea. The grain was, you know, a small amount was allowed to be exported. But meanwhile, the Russians could use their assets in the Black Sea to pummel Ukrainian cities, which they did. But when that, including all last winter, the preceding winter of 2022 to 2023. And so, but once that deal expired, we saw things change because Ukrainians could punch back. And we see that this is precisely an example of why you can't, you're not better off negotiating. The only thing you can do is to defeat the, you know, someone as evil and vile, you know, as Russia here. And so since, well, what we had though, last fall, Ukrainians opened up, they pried open a window. I mean, there were very few missile attacks. Kharkiv last fall, you know, was, I mean, it was almost becoming like Lviv. You had sporadic attacks, but it was very pleasant and very safe. The Russians, their abilities were significantly weakened. They had to divert a lot of resources to moving basically their entire Black Sea fleet away from Crimea and to mainland Russia, and now to occupied parts of Georgia. And so Ukraine had a window, and during this window. You know, Washington sent 17 attack-ins, and that was it. And there was no talk about it. So every time Ukrainians open a window, we miss that opportunity. And I think this is what President Macron, just I guess over a month ago now, you know, he said so clearly. I mean, that speech was incredible. It gave people around Ukraine, people were saying "Vive la France." It gave them encouragement. And he said, "We need to stop speaking in a vocabulary of limits." He said, 2 years ago, we said no tanks to Ukraine. Well, because we were afraid of Russian red lines. Well, then we sent tanks. And okay, what did Russia do? Russia struggled, and Ukraine got more success. 2 years ago, Macron said we sent medium range. We said we would never send medium range weapons to Ukraine. And then we did. And then what? Did the whole world die in nuclear winter? No. And actually, you know, when those HIMARS first arrived in 2022, a Ukrainian city was falling into Russian hands every week, and that stopped because of the HIMARS. We can actually look at the good thing. Whenever America does send these weapons, we see results. So Macron very clearly said this, and then he powerfully said he to the French people, "We don't have to be afraid," he said, and also to Putin and to Russia, he was saying, "We're not, you know, you're not the only nuclear power." He said, "We are a nuclear power. We have a doctrine. We are ready," and it was a change, and it was a character development from who he was in the beginning of this. And the Russians did. The Russians were disturbed, and actually, I mean, on Russian social media, they were just, you could tell they were upset about this because it was so powerful, and yet it barely was in the American headlines. For a couple of reasons. One, the Russians pounded Odessa the next day with one of these double tap attacks that hit rescue workers too. And then, and here's where I know this is extremely revealing about who's on what side and how the Russians are infiltrating and influencing us in America. And I say this, by the way, as someone who doesn't really think that Russia actually controlled the 2016 election. I think they gave us the perception that they had the power to do that, and that was the real power. That's what they're very good at, is making us scared of them. But that same week, when President Macron gave us like the most powerful speech of his life, it was in the format of an interview, and said, you know, we're not like that in Home Alone. I'm not afraid anymore, and no more talking about limits. We're talking about we have red lines, not you, to Russia. Candace Owens, American commentator, popular commentator. She had a video that so curiously was released that week about Macron's wife. This bizarre analysis. She went to detailed analysis saying that Macron is, that Brigitte Macron is a man. It was like 30-minute analysis, 20 million views like in the first few days. And no one asked the question, like, and this was trending on X about Brigitte Macron. And why did Candace Owens, why that week? Why not 6 months ago? Why not 2 weeks ago? It was too uncanny. And it precisely smothered over everything about Macron's speech. Precisely, Jonathan. And this is, the Russians are very adept at steering our narratives. And they've done this when we had power just came back. Let there be light. We have power once again. Go back to that 1 week in January where Ukrainians destroyed three of Russia's 24 most powerful planes that sort of helped to coordinate. Also, that's air alarm. Oh, sorry. I think I lost my video for a second because I'll explain. I don't know if you can you hear the noise.
Yes, is that the air raid app firing off?
Well, so here's the situation in Kharkiv. Because there's limited power, the air alarms that are like the physical ones often don't have power, so they can't sound. And so what happens, and I'm trying to fix my phone here, one second. As an emergency backup, you have this horrible, annoying beep. But this is a little slice of real life here. But that's something that people don't realize it. Even the air raid alarms can't sound when there's no electricity. And so Ukrainians just quickly find some new solution. While we talk, I need to check. This is the routine that you do to check and see why the alarm is sounding. And, you know, you can kind of then figure out how serious is this. And now we're told this is due to there's a Russian MiGs are in the air, which means that, you know, these are capable of carrying in the hypersonic Kinzhal missiles. And I would imagine, let me check, whenever they're in the air, there's alerts throughout the entire nation of Ukraine, which reminds me, a few days ago, time and space are very difficult to manage here sometimes in the war. A few days ago, I was in the Carpathian Mountains in Western Ukraine, just for one day and night. I just needed some rest with no missile attacks. I've been so often here in Kharkiv. I was on a beautiful riverbank. It was the River Opir, which means resistance. Because for 1,000 years, Ukrainians have been sort of protecting Europe from Mongol and Russian hordes at that very point. And it was a lovely, lovely day. And I have a good rest with the fresh mountain air. And at 6 a.m., Vivek, explosions. In my little idyllic Carpathian retreat, I could hear the explosions because the Russians were using drones, and they've been using hypersonic missiles even to hit this little city outside of Lviv called Stry. And it seems that they're looking for gas depots. I mean, as they try to hit the power energy grid here, they want to cut off potential from energy to come in from Europe. And they're also looking to hit military depots. So there I was in my idyllic mountain break. And even there, you feel the war. But anyway, there's no at this moment, there's no indication of anything incoming. But so that the last week in January, Ukraine shot down three of Russia's most powerful, 24 of the most powerful, three of the 24 most powerful attack coordinating planes. That could have been an extraordinary headline. That is. I mean, that's yet another boost for the little guy. You know, at least now and then, how about a nice headline when you do something good, you know? Everyone gets a participation trophy. Ukraine does great things and they can't get a good headline. And what was the headline that week? What was the narrative? It was all about Russia audaciously said, one of those planes had 65 Ukrainian POWs. And they just said this. And now it's months later, there's no follow-up. No one talks about it. There's no investigation. And I was on regular interviews I do. And this is a micro level of just how powerful the Russians are at controlling narrative. You know, I'm going live and, you know, it's a short segment. And I'm asked the question, Joe, what do you think of this? Ukraine shot down 65 of its own prisoners of war on the Russian plane. And for a few seconds, I got sucked into it. I'm talking about Geneva Convention, that the prisoners, you know, they should never have been on there. Russia was violating Geneva Convention. And then I realized that even though I'm criticizing Russia, I'm doing exactly what Russia wants, because I'm deflecting. I'm making, you know, Ukraine look sad and hopeless and weak. but I'm ignoring. Wait, whoa. Extraordinary success. Two A-50s and one IL-76, two spy planes and one sort of transport plane were destroyed by Ukrainians. These three powerful Russian planes, significantly weakening once again Russia's air force, and we have still not a shred of evidence of this POW story. And so, I immediately sort of I realized that, and I brought myself back to it. But you see how even someone like me who's paying attention to this can easily get sucked into the Russian narrative control in the most absurd ways.
And yeah, I mean, we won't even comment on BBC headlines because, again, there seems to be a pattern of incompetent headline writers. The one you mentioned, I've seen that numerous times applied to numerous different occasions. And of course, if we're trapped in our partisan political bubble, and for much of this 2 years, you know, we've been not perhaps sort of querying the motives and strategy behind Biden's administration. Now, as we approach a potential Trump victory, of course, there's a certain amount of hysteria about that. But I think what Macron's change in stance suggests is something far more concerning, and that this isn't, you know, just a threat from the MAGA GOP right, that actually we have a systemic dysfunction within the US system, and that actually Europe needs to wake up. NATO has started to take moves to almost plan for a future without the US actively participating. We need to wake up strategically and realize that the US is not going to come and save Europe. It is going to be distracted by its own traumas, potentially.
Yeah, and I think here's where we see, you know, I think one reason why in the political elite in Washington, we see there is, you know, such a hatred of Trump is because he says what they actually, a lot of them actually believe, and they would never say in public. There was a video of this with Trump and Pelosi and Schumer were negotiating in the Oval Office. And Trump was just talking with them. They were, you know, there's a bit of a like playground screaming match. And I think Schumer said, let's talk about this after with no cameras. Because that no one wants that to be revealed. And so I think that, so, you know, it's, you know, Trump will say what he thinks, you know, whatever about all this stuff. But a lot of people actually de facto are the same. And it's like, we can criticize Elon Musk for wanting to give up on Eastern Ukraine. Well, that's, you know, in different words, that's pretty much what Secretary Blinken is saying by only talking about Kyiv. I mean, it's sickening. Let's, you know, if we go back, there's a pattern of this on, you know, we've seen this in history before in the UK in the 1930s as well. But, you know, go back to George H.W. Bush, 1991, his Chicken Kyiv speech, telling Ukrainians, keep your cute little freedom in check. You don't really stay with Mother Russia. This is what the CIA guy, former director of the CIA, says. I don't think Ronald Reagan ever would have said that. But George H.W. Bush gave that speech. And then Clinton, Clinton, to his credit, apologized for this, you know, pushing Ukraine to give up its nuclear weapons. And then in 2000, early 2000s, then Senator Barack Obama, Democrat, and then the late Senator, I think late, Richard Lugar, Republican, bipartisan effort to get Ukraine, not only the nukes were gone, to give up its best weapons in the early 2000s. And then in 2014, with the Revolution of Dignity, when Ukrainians would do something that everyone who's like in MAGA movements or RFK movements, Robert Kennedy Jr., all, you know, all these people who, and Black Lives Matter, anyone who feels frustrated with the system could look to that Revolution of Dignity and see a blueprint on how you could achieve how people can control society. Because, you know, the people of Hong Kong, by the way, they were in a dire straits, more than many people protesting, and they looked to Ukraine as an example. And when that happened in 2014, you had the American officials, you know, trying, you know, the narrative is that the Americans were creating this. They were trying to mitigate it. They were trying to find a way to manage it. And you had then Prime Minister of Poland, who's now once again Prime Minister of Poland, Donald Tusk. He told the protesters, he said, and I think this is very revealing to probably the mindset in the White House now. He said, negotiate. You know, we're going to, you know, you've done a good job protesting for months. You resisted the bullets to the secret police, but you need to negotiate now. You can get some good concessions. We'll have elections, you know, sometime in the magical future. But if you don't negotiate, you're all going to die. And the protesters said, no, sorry. By the protesters, I mean the people of this country, all different ages in the squares of their cities. And this is like going back to like the Viking thing, you know, the ancient parliaments on the hill. The leaders of the protesters came to the square, the Maidan, and they said, here's what the Europeans tell us to do. And the people said no. And within a few days, the regime, the pro-Putin regime, fled. Now, there was some kind of truth to Tusk's words. In that moment, the people won. But we see now, I mean, it's because of that we face billions of dollars worth of missiles and drones every week. And so there is a truth to that. But it comes down to people who believe, who want to manage things and think that keep, you know, keeping some semblance of peace is much more important than some idea of being free. These are people who like to control, to manage things. And this is their mentality and who they are. And I think they lack an imagination or ability to believe in victory. I think to believe that, but it's to believe that people can be free. And free, you know, this is a hard thing for us as Americans to, and, you know, it's even as I, as an American, you know, in order to be free, look at everything our founding fathers, you know, all the theories and going back to Aristotle, like you have to have some strong culture, some bonds that help you cooperate and work with each other. I see that here. And that's why Ukrainians are able to be free. But, you know, in America, it's hard for us to see that possibility. And so I think that this is part of the reason why our leaders don't care so much about freedom. I don't know, John. I mean, what do you have a pinpoint analysis of why?
I think I did float this idea to someone that actually Ukrainian style of freedom, because it's worked, one of the few examples in history of it actually working, because it's not just a mob rule, that there's method there, there's techniques which are copyable. You know, if you can try to reproduce that effect, it's exceedingly threatening. So no one I've spoken to would sign up to the idea that actually, you know, America and others are not so hot on Ukrainian freedom because it threatens their own privilege and status. But I think there's a certain lack of recognition, because freedom, I think, as it's come to be in our sort of fat consumerist societies that have not had to face these difficult life and death decisions for many decades, freedom is very much associated with privilege and status. And let's face it, you know, someone like Jake Sullivan is a classic example of privilege, status, assumptions, and almost like a God-given right to rule, etc. Whereas what Ukrainians doing here is saying that actually freedom is about participation. Freedom is about expending your energy and your imagination and taking risks. It's not about power being consolidated in the hands of oligarchs, corporations, and so on. It's a very threatening idea. But I think we've come to associate freedom with things that actually are antithetical to Ukrainian freedom. And actually, this is why I think, you know, if we're going to be completely selfish about it, we need to help Ukraine survive, because actually we need to learn. We need to relearn and reinvigorate our own systems and move them away from the idea of privilege and status being synonymous with freedom, because that's sclerotic. That is the death knell, I think, of our societies.
Well, and this is precisely a storyline that I think the people who feel sort of dispossessed and like that they have no agency in America, and I understand why. I mean, they feel disconnected. You know, life is quite difficult. And that's why every American I know who comes to Ukraine is so happy here. Even like I was in a bomb shelter today with Americans who had just arrived, and they're seeing Ukrainians they know, and the building's shaking and everyone's hugging each other and smiling. But they've built such a lovely country and society. And Americans are tired, and they feel disconnected from the process of politics. I mean, we have lots of corruption in America, and, you know, corporations write our laws and all this, and we feel how, you know, so to those people, I think if they could understand that, you know, what, think about why is Russia spending so much money and time and resources to destroy this country? And the answer is precisely because Ukrainians have figured out how they did for, you know, they have still, it's still, you know, they still have it, but especially 2014 to 2022, they figured out how to, after centuries of struggle, how to enshrine their freedom, wild freedom, freedom of the people, at the, you know, like subsidiarity, right? The people, you know, faith, family, freedom, how to protect that, how to flourish in that environment, how not to be controlled by elites, how not to have corporations controlling what you eat. You know, think of the Americans, I forget, some cereal company saying, oh, we know it's tough in America, eat cereal for dinner, you know, just poison yourself. And like, I know Americans are waking up to this and they're sick of it. Ukrainians are one of the last examples in the world, or maybe the fiercest example, of people that hold on to their ancient traditions while also innovating. And they do this in this real spirit of freedom. So much so that, you know, even the police bow before the people. I mean, the people really rule here. And this is such a threat, not only to Moscow, but to powerful people in Berlin, in Paris, and in Washington, and all over the world. I mean, this is, they don't want the revolution apart. You know, it's, if you could get more Americans in particular, and I focus on that because that's, I mean, like the UK is doing really a lot by sending storm shadow missiles, which Ukrainians are continuing to use with great effect in Crimean Peninsula. But America, you know, they hold the keys to turning this around so much more quickly. And but this could really reawaken America. And this is the narrative that the powerful elite do not want Americans to know. And the Russian propagandists do not want the Americans to know. And, you know, a great example of it is Hong Kong. I mean, and Hong Kong makes me sad every time I think about it. But in 2019, in particular, the people, they saw that China was trying to strangle them finally. And sometimes there was like 1/7 of the population of that city, the extraordinary numbers, out protesting when they still had the ability to do so. And they were waving Hong Kong flag, British flag, and the Ukrainian flag, because they, in their dire situation, knew that Ukrainians had figured out how to create some protective mechanism around your freedom. And it's not about governments, it's about the people, it's about the Maidan, the public square. In Hong Kong, that law, it failed. When the coronavirus arrived and the Chinese were able to stop it, Beijing was able to stop it, the government. And but so if people in such dire straits could respect Ukraine, you know, why can't Americans see this? And if they did, maybe it would begin to open up the possibility. And I've asked so many people here, you know, how, I mean, what is the magic? You know, what enabled Ukrainians to find this freedom and to, you know, to be willing to face the threats of, you know, missiles and drones and bullets and, you know, I mean, every day. I mean, I was talking to people today who were at a funeral of a yet another soldier fallen in battle. And, you know, it starts with something very micro. And there was a right before the revolution of dignity, like 2012, 2013, you know, people were trying to make their lives better after the hell of the century of Sovietism. And in these Soviet era apartment buildings that are in many cities in Ukraine, everything was controlled by like some central authority. And so no one took care of common spaces. It was all controlled by the central authority. And a movement began for people to control their buildings. But in order to do that, they actually had to participate. They'd have to go to monthly meetings together and say, okay, how do we manage our park, our playground, our common space, our stairwells? And they began to work together, and they forged ties with each other and their neighbors. And so many people I speak to say that the revolution of dignity worked because of that. That was the turning point, and that was what created and then it spread out to neighborhoods, and it wasn't just in the Soviet buildings, but that was what created this horizontal strengthening of ties among the citizens. That when the, you know, the pro Putin regime began to shoot the people, they were ready and prepared, because you can't just have a revolution overnight. You have to build a strong society, and that's really the key. And this is what Ukraine could show to Americans. But this is what Russia is trying to erase, because it's such a threat to the people who love to control. And we know these people. Read Shakespeare, read Macbeth, read Shakespeare. This is a part of, you know, humanity. And I think when folks like Blinken and Jake Sullivan and the White House and Berlin and other places, they don't want to admit it. They are also threatened by this radical idea of freedom. And that's why they don't run to support it. And that's why Javier Milei does. But yeah, sorry.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think what also is not understood, because of course it's a very managerial point of view, isn't it, that you can somehow negotiate with tyranny, that somehow you can balance a war, that you can manage risk, somehow you can control a situation and normalize it. I mean, this is a very managerial response, is to normalize everything that goes on, even if you're living in absolutely extraordinary times. We see this happening over and over again in the media. You know, the amount of absolutely bonkers things that Trump said and some of the things he did, off the scale, and yet almost immediate attempt to normalize what's happening. Similarly, you know, normalization of an absolutely outrageous policy that's now admitted by Blinken to conduct a war. No war has ever been won in history in the fashion that they are, claiming Ukraine should behave. And based on what you've said, Ukraine won't behave. But the last idea here to finish on is freedom. Freedom is indivisible and it's incompatible with tyranny. So those who are thinking that somehow we can accommodate Putin, that somehow he'll agree to be contained and to allow our values to sit side by side with his, that is, I think, deeply illusory. And even if Ukraine comes to a sort of standstill or a forced negotiation or whatever, I know Ukrainians won't accept that. That won't stop the aggression. That won't stop the force of tyranny trying to erode and destroy our values. And if they can't do it externally, they will do it internally. And as we know, as you said earlier, Russia is extremely good at that kind of weaponized lying and narrative spinning.
Yeah, and agree. Jonathan, I should make clear that I from everyone I know in Washington and my experience there, I equate what the White House's actions, like you could, like Trump's mouth and White House's actions are the same right now. Actually, it's the same. And if we can realize this and we have a way out of it, we can start to say, get more people to wake up and say, wait, because it's just a very clear point. So Trump's blah, 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 and the White House actions are actually, it's a beautiful Trumpian golden marriage.
It's a systemic problem now. Yeah, it's not a partisan
problem.
Yeah, we see
it in Washington. Yeah, exactly. And but on this, look at just in the past couple of weeks, for the first time since World War II, as far as I can tell, air raid alarms sounded in the country of Moldova. Several times in the past few weeks, Poland has scrambled F-16s. Russia is getting, sloppier and lazy, in a way. They don't care anymore because they see that they can push and push and push. And Ukrainians will resist, but they're trying to hide that from the world. And they see that the West, doesn't really react. And so you have missiles flying over Moldova, Romania, and Poland now, at least briefly. And we can easily see how this can spill out into those countries. So that's why I do think we see some Europeans waking up, but yet they still, they miss this simple, it's a simple thing, just send weapons to Ukraine. It's it. The Ukrainians are, they're not asking for soldiers. They're saying, send us tools. And yet these countries are stocking up and getting everything they need. I mean, 2023 was the best year ever for sales of American defense products because you're getting the world scared and they're buying stuff. Oh, and what is the this absurd thing that Argentina, the United States last fall gave F-16s to Argentina, and Denmark is giving some F-16s, maybe. I mean, everyone promises this, but 2 years we never see it, to Ukraine, but they're giving more F-16s to Argentina. What are we preparing? Is Argentina preparing to take the Falklands? But I don't know. I mean, what, are they threatened by Brazil? What is going on? Why are they willing to? And this is the same when people talk about rebuilding. They have these fancy conferences in London. They want to do everything, then talk about the clear and present danger because it's scary and it's messy and it's difficult. And yet when you're here in Ukraine, you see that, yeah, it's difficult, but it's possible to win. It's, you know, and you learn so much. I was talking with a friend in Donbass. We were on a mission delivering these drone jammers a few weeks ago, and I'll do that again soon in Donbass. And we came up with this idea how war can fix your brain, you know, because you can't live in fantasy land. You have to say, hey, these people want to destroy us. If we live under them, we have no freedom. So we have to find ways to fight back. And the more people can be, hopefully, like Macron, we'll see, you know, if there's, you know, actions. I mean, it's promising signs from Paris, especially the way that the foreign minister criticized Blinken to his face. If we can see more of that, we could, you know, every time we can plot it, every time Ukrainians are given great tools, they very swiftly use them to great effect. It's very simple. We can see the evidence of it. So why not send more? And after every one of these sort of infusions of support for Ukraine, we see a weakening of Russia. So we can use that to find some strength and courage. And that's what I keep trying to share to the world. And Jonathan, that's why I think about it every time when I'm on that train coming east here to Kharkiv. Sometimes I wake up on the train, I'm like, what am I doing, man? I'm going right to the edge. But that's because this is the place that shows the possibility of victory and of courage and inspiration.
It's the place where the solution resides and the will to protect what you value. We didn't even get on to Havana syndrome, but again, to your point there, the reaction of a Trump White House may be not so different from Biden. One would claim it's a full story. On the other hand, it's completely ignored, barely covered at all. And yet the implications, if true, are stunning. It's essentially proof that Russia has declared war on the West many years ago and has been conducting offensive operations against State Department officials. In the Cold War, that would have been a trigger for extraordinary escalation. Now people are afraid of taking action, afraid of defending freedom, afraid of defining what that freedom is and what diminishes it and what increases it. Even having that discussion, which is so natural, I think, to have with Ukrainians, is a difficult discussion to have with others who aren't in Ukraine.
So I think we have to make America feel good again. We gotta believe in who we are. But that starts in our, as Ukrainians did, starts in your communities, and you have to build up nice society. People are doing this and trying it. And this is the movement I see of people trying to eat better food and not corporate stuff. And that's like, and if someone could find a way to bring these things together, we could find a way to believe in ourselves again. And by the way, that I see that every day here. In Ukraine, you have Americans to the left and the right who come here and they work together in a way that we don't see in America, because they have common mission and purpose, and they see the things that transcend that. It's really, this is a way to fix it. How Ukraine's resistance can fix your brain, I think, is the key. And maybe in the future, we can talk about how a few years ago, I was living in Philadelphia, and Russian agents came after me. So I've known, that was in 2015 or so. The FBI informed me, but I already had a good suspicion of it. And I'd formerly worked at Fox, but I wasn't anyone particularly influential, and they were coming after me. So they've been, for a long time, Russians have been trying here's what they've done. I mean, they were inviting many groups of Americans every year for about 15 years from the early 2000s on free junkets to Moscow and St. Petersburg. And they invite top journalists and entrepreneurs and politicians. And I was warned about this. I didn't go. But just imagine the cameras that they had in the hotel rooms. And when you look at people who refuse, this is the dirtiest part of it. It's not just about principles and ideas, but look at the people who are opposing support for Ukraine. And just see, you know, maybe there's some dirt on them. Moscow has been very, and as we look at the Savannah syndrome story, Moscow has been very adept at these types of attacks and controlling people. They have a lot of power as a result, and they've taken representation away from the American people. So that's important. So
it's a mafia behavior, isn't it? You know, either you coerce, and if people refuse to be coerced, then you hurt them. And this is, it's a very simple equation. It's a mafia mindset.
Yeah, indeed. And by the way, I think last important thing to mention as we fight against this mafia mindset, you know, I look at Mike Johnson, the Speaker of the House, and his district in Northwest Louisiana is very evangelical. And if those people in his district knew what Russians do to evangelicals, to any Christian in occupied territories, they would probably turn into the Cajun Navy and get over here. Not only would they start voting to demanding support for Ukrainians, but they'd probably want to come and help. There's no freedom of religion in Russia unless you're part of the state religion. And this is what I can't figure out. Americans who hate statism allegedly are not, you know, they don't realize Ukrainians are fighting against statism better than anyone. And if Ukrainians lose that, then that fight is lost for maybe a century. It is because Ukrainians are the example of how you can resist. Including the evangelical Christians, especially in occupied Zaporizhia and Kherson, and the stories of what the Russians have done there are absolutely atrocious, and turning evangelical churches into Russian cultural centers that, you know, with pictures of Stalin and Putin. If you see the reality here, I think once if people simply knew that, I think they would, their minds would change quite quickly.
It's incredibly important to get the message across, and that makes what you're doing incredibly important at this time. Hopefully, reaching out to people who will listen and change their points of view and take action to get in touch with their congressman and so on. Joe, it's been brilliant talking to you, as it always is. I know everyone on the channel wishes you to stay safe and look after yourself, especially given the position Kharkiv is in. And we appreciate your broadcasting daily from the pointy end.
Jonathan, thank you so much. You can catch that if you go to UkrainianFreedomNews.com. You can see our YouTube channel where I post my daily broadcasts on Chicago's WGN Radio every single weekday for 2 years. And my T-shirt today, a gift from friends in Lviv, says "Malo po malo," which means little by little, step by step. That's the only way to fight against tyranny. Just every day, keep going. So, thank you, Jonathan.